Hello, dear internet strangers. Today is Thursday, March 31st, and we are Talking in Obscurity, companion podcast to Writing in Obscurity. I am Kevin Carlson, and joined by my co-host,
Steve Kubitz.
And today we are talking about Human Heirs, written by Nathan H. Lentz.
Yeah, this is a very, I would say, kind of a different book than we've sort of covered on this little podcast.
Yeah, it was my pick, and it's a nonfiction. Yeah. I do nonfiction too.
Which is, yeah, rare. Usually I'm the one picking nonfiction, and you're the one picking all that boring, like, no. Sad, scary stuff.
But no, you've picked some sad, scary stuff too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are just as sad inside as I am.
Probably sadder.
Okay, I don't really want to have that competition with you.
But no, I mean, just a quick little thing. I enjoyed the hell out of this book, man. I got to tell you.
I'm glad.
You've been recommending this book for a while to me.
Yep.
Like, I feel like probably over a year. This book recommendation probably predates this podcast by a pretty substantial amount.
Yep, and now I finally managed to blackmail you into doing this. The whole reason we do this podcast was for this day.
And it was, I got to say, man, I'm not a big, like, science guy. I trust science, and I'm not one of those, I don't trust science, I don't like science. I'm not a scientist, and nor do I have a scientifically driven mind. Mm. But this book really blew me away in a lot of ways, and, you know, I'm really glad I read it.
That's because it's funny. It's a funny book. And, like, they all said I was crazy, and Kevin's an old fool. But, yeah, it's a funny book, isn't it?
Funnier than it has any right to be.
Yeah.
Given the subject matter.
Yeah. So, like, that's my first love of this book.
Or just diving right in, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, where are we at?
Yeah. True story.
We're here talking about books. That's my first love of it, is that it is surprisingly funny. And I know the part of it, like, when I was immediately pulled into it, is how, and I'm going to paraphrase this because I don't remember the exact bit, but the book opens with, there are countless books about the human form and the human animal that talks about how we're this pristine work of biological engineering and how beautiful our form is and all that. And then it goes into the next line of, this is not one of those books.
Yeah, that's a great line.
That's where I immediately got hooked into this. The subsequent chapters of this whole I almost said novel, but it's not fiction. It's what we all live with as being humans, is just about how terribly designed we are and how shitty, if anybody was ever looking at us, like, why these parts of us don't work and how inefficient we are. And it's very surprising, a lot of this stuff. Like, people know about how your appendix doesn't really do anything anymore, but there's all kinds of stuff. And, like, until somebody points it out to you, you don't really actually, like, consider, like, why are our wrists the way they are?
I feel bad for piggybacking, but my first love of this book is that it's funny. You know, and what's interesting about it is that so there are certain things in the sort of realm of science that are so dry, and they're talking about really interesting things. And I say this so in art, in the sort of intellectual realm. I love a lot of history books. I read a ton of history books. And a lot of them are really interesting because I love history. But if you try to give to someone that isn't into that, they're going to find them boring as hell. And I found a lot of science books are like that for me, where I'm like, okay, yeah, it's important, it's fascinating stuff, but it's just kind of there. This, you know, this writer, you know, this Nathan H. Lentz, you know, what he does, he's so witty, and he's so engaging that these things that could easily be very boring and sort of just wordy and just, okay, whatever, becomes, like, enthralling, and you're fascinated by it. And, like, that is an amazingly, like, narrow, like, line to walk, and he freaking hop skips over it. Like, he's amazing at it.
I think that, like, getting into, like, the specifics of things that I learned in this book that I find deeply fascinating, and the first thing that I think is interesting is how he points out, you ever notice that dogs and cats and really any animal you pick doesn't get scurvy like we do? Because, and just so you know, in case you're not aware of what scurvy is, it's a disease that is specific to humans and certain other primates. If you don't get enough vitamin C, you basically fall apart. It was a big problem for ancient sailors because they would have a whole lot of hardtack and salted meat, but no oranges or anything that had any vitamin C. So, you know, they'd go out to sea and then dive scurvy. So the reason dogs and cats and almost every other animal on Earth doesn't ever get scurvy, they can eat the same thing over and over again and not die, is because their bodies actually make their own vitamin C, make most of the vitamins that they need. And the interesting thing about humans is it isn't that we don't have the genes that do that. It's just that our gene in our distant past is broken. And like, and we've just been replicating the same shitty, broken gene throughout the generations in every society of humankind over the years. And that shows that, like, that evolution can do things that are not necessarily positive, because people have this misconception that evolution makes things better or stronger. It just really is determining why things pass on to the next generation. And what's interesting is you'd think that, like, suddenly losing the ability to make vitamin C would be a terrible detriment. Why would natural selection not weed that out in us? It's because if you think about where we used to live, right along the equator, where there's all kinds of fruit trees which have plentiful vitamin C. So it makes a whole lot of sense why we have this flaw.
See, if we're going to do that, we're going to sort of go in things I learned and liked about this book. So I mentioned this before in this podcast. So I have Crohn's disease. And part of that, I have obscenely low vitamin D levels. Most people in Eastern, like anywhere that there's winter, usually has low vitamin D. I border on where it's like it becomes an actual problem. That's why I have to take a vitamin D supplement twice a day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so whatever, it happens. And the one thing, I never realized this. I always thought, okay, people don't have vitamin, they get it from the sun. That's how we get it. And it just happens. I realized, I learned that humans actually make vitamin D in spades. We make plenty of it. Problem is, we make it in our lower colon and we immediately poop it out. When I read that, I guess in this case, because it's, spoilers, everyone out there listening on Audible. When I heard that, I was like so mad. And then the funny thing is, this book's so funny that it takes a break from all the hard science stuff and goes, oh, just see if you, for those wondering out there, if you're ever stuck in a desert island and you need vitamin D, yes, you can eat your own poop, but I wouldn't recommend it. And if that isn't like the perfect encapsulation of why like the human body's a mess. And like, but the thing, it's, to balance it, the thing that I find very kind of beautifully poetic about this book that I loved is that it brings up how sickle cell anemia is a trait that very specifically, almost exclusively affects people in Africa. That was a huge problem in Africa and still is in America. You see in African American communities almost predominantly. Mm. And it's fascinating because if your parents are, say one parent's a carrier of that gene and you're a byproduct of it, you don't get the sickle cell anemia, but you get this really convenient resistance to malaria, which, how incredible is that? This horrible disease that can be like just a terrible life. If you get just a part of the gene, instead of getting the disease, you get this amazing little superpower where you think about the part of the world where, Africa, where, malaria is a real killer.
Yeah, I think that's because I'm not a doctor, obviously, but I believe it's because sickle cell is a recessive trait. It's a recessive gene that causes this. And so if you have, with any recessive trait, if you only have one copy of it, it doesn't become the disease. But like, it doesn't mean that it doesn't present at all. And in this case, it's that resistance to malaria. And like, that's just a guy who's read all this book a few times talk though, so don't like quote me on that for
you don't if you advice. Don't go around taking don't take medical advice from us. Listen to your doctor or listen to Joe Rogan.
He has a bigger podcast, that's how you know.
Yeah, that's how you know he's legit.
He has cameras and everything.
Yeah. Jamie, pull that up. it's sort of back to, the things we love about this book. The one thing that I found amazing, we sort of hinted at a little bit, is that this book deals with very heavy, intense science stuff. And it'd be very easy for it to be, what? But this writer makes it so easy to understand in a way that's not condescending. Mm-hmm. You don't feel like you're being talked down to. And that's, again, that's pretty hard to pull off. And this book, you know, if you've ever been, we've all been to science classes when you were a kid, and you're probably like, this is like, it's funny. The stuff that now I'm fascinated by, I know for a fact when I was like in ninth grade, I was bored by.
Yeah, I think that the interesting, though, is the fine line that he walks is because I don't think that you really need to have any real strong science background to enjoy this. It's just how well written it is. But yet, like you said, it doesn't feel like you're being talked down like you're an idiot. Like I would feel like the average person, wherever you're at, and it makes the science, in this context, the human body and the human form, it makes it interesting and approachable. Another thing that I wanted to get into, what I like, is about, like, I believe I talked earlier about how, why R.R. Risk that way, is he goes into how many bones you really have that just float around in your wrists that don't do anything. And then, like, if you were approaching designing a human from scratch, it would make much more sense to make your hands on a ball joint. And you don't even think about this, because that would mean that your hands could move 360 degrees and go in any direction, instead of, like, if your hands are, like, you know, people hands, they only flex so far. You can't, like, take your knuckles and put them back on your forearm unless you're extremely flexible or have broken wrists.
Which is, yeah, that's a problem.
And, like, and he even brings out how, like, you can try this at home. Rotate your arm, your forearm, 180 degrees so your palm is facing up. And then do it the other way so that your palm is facing down. That's fine. And you can even twist your arm a little bit further. Try that with your leg under your knee. It doesn't work. Like, it's almost the same sort of biology, but, like, your leg can't flex like that. And it's, again, if you're designing a person from scratch, why wouldn't these things do this?
Yeah, that to me is, like, probably the thing about this book that I found most, like, engaging is that you learn things about our sort of bodies that, like, just aren't marvelous. And it's so funny. So I was talking to my stepdad a little bit about this book. We went for a walk or something. And my stepdad's like, well, no, we're a marvelous design. We're not.
No.
And he was so, like, flabbergasted and taken aback by some of the little, like, quirks of humanity that I don't think you ever thought about.
Yeah, I think that's what it, like, forces you to think about is all the design inefficiencies in humans. And the thing that I think that beautifully encapsulates why everything in our bodies are the way that they are is that natural selection and adaptation and evolution is really good at modifying structures that already exist. So, and, like, he goes on, like, to touch on, like, with birds. All mammals sort of have that. Mammals and birds and similar animals have the same sort of structure of four limbs and a head attached to a trunk. From horses to dogs to cats to lions to zebras to giraffes, we all have these four limbs and a head attached to our trunk here. But it would make much more sense for birds to have an extra set of arms with hands versus giving up their arms and hands to have wings. It's because their wings are what our arms are in their body plan. And this is really about human heirs and not bird heirs, but that's the point I'm making, is that every structure about us, from our eyes, which have the retinas, are backwards, so that's why we have blind spots, to our sense of taste and our sense of smell. Another thing that I thought was really interesting is he talks about how dogs don't get head colds because their sinus is drained correctly. It's just how the holes in their sinus is at the back, drains right into the back of their throat, whereas our sinus goes all the way up our nose and is actually higher up in our skull than where our nostrils are. So that means that anytime you want to, like, do one of these, it has to go up and against the force of gravity.
Oh, trigger one in there for the, you know, people that are grossed out by the nose clearing sound. But no, it's interesting because I feel like you could do a whole just discussion about all the things about this book that made you realize how, like, not great humans are designed. Because that's the crux of this book, is that it's just humans are not really that well designed. You know, I know people like to kind of romanticize humanity, like we're this special, like, perfectly, you know, we're these perfect creatures of, like, you know,
whatever. And look how pretty we are.
But we're not. You know, and this book really, you know, in the sort of another like about this book, you know, I really enjoyed learning Mm. I know it sounds so like basic, but like it felt nice to learn. So that's not learn a topic. It's not usually my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Like I spend a lot of time reading history books, and you know, I love things like that. I love that's what I'm passionate about. You know, science, which I believe strongly in, but I don't know a lot about it. And to learn about it like this felt really cool. It felt nice to be like, wow, it's like, I was excited to talk to my wife about like all the little things I was learning. And she was so indifferent to my,
like, Stephen, it's 3 a.m.
Like, that's nice. Like,
please go back to sleep.
Go to bed. You know, but for me, I just felt, I love learning stuff. So like, it felt really fun to be like, well, you know, let me tell you about this like thing that like, I'm like a little kid. I'm like running home from school. Like, guess what? I learned from this book today. I was on my walk. You know what I read? And I learned that humans make vitamin D, but then we poop it out.
I wonder what with like the practical reason for all the junk DNA, but you do you.
Yeah, my wife's like, that's nice, honey. Like,
I mean, I think you would be especially primed with the autoimmune sections of these things.
Oh, the autoimmune thing was, I love. So, for those aren't familiar, like I said, I have Crohn's, and it is essentially the body making a horrible mistake. And this book, I felt very seen by this book, like because for Crohn's, it's my immune system going, I'm really tough. I'm gonna show how tough I am. I'm gonna attack my own intestines and colon and stomach because I don't give a shit. That's how crazy I am. And all the viruses come in like, holy fuck, this dude is crazy. Like,
yeah, but like you still get sick. I mean, you don't have like some superpower here.
No, I still get sick. Yeah, but I would say like the problem is where you get in trouble if you have any kind of like Crohn's or any kind of like autoimmune similar to that vein. You have to take medicine to make medicine work. You basically have to dull your immune system a little bit, and that's what makes like you susceptible to more like intense things because you have no choice. You have to, because your immune system is working pretty much overtime all the time.
Yeah, I think that that's something that he even brings up is that like the Greek tragedy of the human immune system is that, well, it forgot that this part of you is you, so it just attacks it, and it can't unlearn that. For some reason.
It's just again, human body's dumb. It's a marvel, but it's a dumb marvel.
Yeah, I mean, there are things about the human body that are amazing. Like, our brains are amazing. But the process of how they came to be and why they are the way they are is supremely unromantic. And I think that's what I like the most about this book, is that it's funny and that, like, because it takes the idea that we are these perfect, smart creatures and points out all of the flaws. Like, the fact that it makes certain concepts, like the fact that we've dominated the Earth and we're the top species on this planet, and the fact that, like, there's so many of us that there's a problem that we have such overpopulation. But whenever you talk about our reproductive abilities, we're one of the worst primates.
We're so inefficient at it.
Yeah, we are. Our males have to produce so much sperm because all of our sperm tends to go one direction, can't turn left. And, like, they have the Zoolander problem of, like, can't turn left. Like, that's why you have to make millions and millions and millions of sperm. And if you only make, like 1 million, you're considered inefficient.
Yeah, you're low. It's like, you're horrible.
You're probably never going to have kids.
Which, like, yeah, the women... their bodies aren't really we're in there not long enough because but the thing is our bodies aren't big enough to hold
because the heads are too big.
Yeah,
so big, like, weird heads.
But so I love the fact like we're the only thing once we're born we're not ready yet.
Yeah, every human being whenever they're born is underbaked.
Yeah,
and that's just the problem. Well, I think we need to shift into the hard part of this.
The dislikes.
Are what we don't love about this book, because there's so much that I love about this book. But to kick us off, I think that Lentz is a little harsh on the vegans and vegetarians, because he talks about the different stuff that we just need, like certain vitamins, because, again, humans are really bad at diet. That's why we have to eat so many things versus other animals that can basically eat
one or two things.
Corn all day long and be fine. But for us, we have to eat so many weird things to just live a healthy life. So he takes a real, like, there's certain nutrients that you just don't find that often in most vegetables. So, like, and that's a fair point to make, but I feel like he at times takes it to this level of, like, your decision to be a vegetarian or a vegan is wrong, and you should feel wrong. And those parts made me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah,
Not that I'm a vegetarian. I eat too much meat.
Yeah. It's funny. My primary sort of issue with this book, it's in a weird way, it's not even really a negative of the book. It made me really hate my own body. And not
just those real other people's problems.
And not in like a vanity way. Like, oh, I really could work out more. In the, what the hell are you doing? Like, what is all this? Like, really? This is the best, like...
I think you're never going to recover from the vitamin D thing.
I'm so mad about that. Like, because that, to me, was like the... Really?
To know that you have to eat all of these supplements of vitamin D. All the vitamin D in the world that you would ever need goes down the toilet.
I flush it. The multiple times a day, I fucking go to the bathroom. Like... Yeah, that's
huge
fine.
Source of vitamin D.
And for someone with Crohn's, that I'm wasting valuable vitamin D every like 2 hours. This is ridiculous. That to me was like such a, like, it really just made me realize, like, wow. Because not that I've ever been like a person that really thought the human body was that much of a marvel. Because I've seen I personally know what can go awry.
I mean, you have a human body, and it isn't great.
It ain't great. But just to hear about you hear about all these things that just go wrong. You're like, oh my, like, how did we get this far? It's amazing when you think about it. Because it really is a question of, it isn't just that we're poorly, because we're not poorly designed in the sense that, like, we do work. I think the metaphor he used that was really brilliant was that the human body in a lot of ways is like a junky car.
Mm-hmm.
It's still running. It's still doing its thing. But it probably could be a little more efficient if it added a few changes here and there. Like, and yeah. that's the human body.
And like the problem with like biology is forever basically until very recently, the only way to change any of this stuff is through natural selection. And again, natural selection is just what happens to survive, not was that good or bad, just that it did. And there's the great dice of chance behind that, where like the whole thing with the vitamin C is the only reason that you don't make your own vitamin C is that one of our ancestors that we all share in common had a mutation, and he or she did not die off whenever would have been convenient, and now we just all have that shitty gene.
I really hate Uncle Tim.
I'm straying back into the things that I liked about this, but like I'm gonna justify it by like this creeps me out. So that's like a dislike. Whenever he's talking about junk DNA and the utility of that is that the reason that you don't instantly die every time you get a sunburn, and because a sunburn will usually, it'll mess up your DNA a little bit, and that's part of the damage, and like your body corrects for that. But you get hit by all kinds of things throughout your life, like X-rays or whatever, that's going to knock some of your DNA around. But the reason you don't like instantly get cancer and die is that most of it does nothing. It's all most like the actual genome that describes you is very, very little. And of that functional bit, most of it is the same as anything else. And like it brings up this point of like you share like 70% of your DNA with bananas, and actually it'd be weird if you didn't. But I'm straying from my point. Another thing that happens is that certain viruses get stuck in the DNA, and like they, because that's what a virus is, it's like it's RNA that like acts as a virus, and it's inactive, it's dead, but like it gets stuck in our genetic code and just gets dutifully replicated with every successive generation. So we are all riddled with ancient viruses that don't do anything, that bad or good, but we've just been bringing this along with us all the way from the dawn of time, basically.
It really is amazing that we haven't all just, that we've made it this far. And I mean that sincerely. Like, it's not, like, I think the real marvel of humanity is we're still kicking.
Yeah, I mean...
Like, more so than anything is that, like...
This isn't really this book, but, like, there have been a few times where we probably almost died out. That's why we share so many traits that are similar.
It's just kind of amazing that we made it this far. And I don't know, in terms of like dislikes, originally I was going to say something like, you know, the chapters are a little like, some of them are great, but some of them are a little clunky where they bounce back and forth, or they, you're on a topic that you really like, mm-hmm. and then it just shifts to something else. And you're like, oh, wait, no, what about the thing you were, no, I want to go back.
Go back.
You know, and I feel like I think that's kind of like, whenever a really smart person is really passionate about something, their brain's just wired a little differently.
Yeah.
So that's just, that's the way they can do that. They can bounce back around and like they bounce back and forth. And I think that like a lot of times this book suffers from that a little bit, where it feels like it just goes from like, you'll be getting into the meat of something. You think, okay. And then it's, I don't know, a whole different thing. You're like, wait, what? Why? Why would you do that? Like,
it's like that going back, like play Freebird.
Yeah. Go back. Yeah. And you know, and don't get me wrong, like, that's not, the chapters are also pretty long, you know, in a lot of cases. Most of them are at least, I think, 45 minutes to an hour, if not.
Yeah, I think they're all over an hour.
You know, and I'll tell you this, though, even though that's the case, that they're all an hour, more of a positive, I never at one point felt like this book dragged, which, kudos, to, seriously, because that's impressive. But that's sort of my main little, like, sort of gripe with sort of the content of it, is that it feels like it sort of loses itself every now and then.
Yeah, but I still think that, like, you could pretty much pick up this book from any chapter, any point in any chapter, and be entertained from that point forward. Like, I have gone back and listened to bits and pieces of this, and then ended up listening to the rest of the book, just because, like, I just get so... I get dragged in so much, but, like, again, another thing that creeps me out, we're used to thinking of cancer as a terrible disease, and everybody hopes that they and their loved ones never get it. But, like, he really burst the bubble on cancer isn't so much a disease as it is an inevitability, where if you live long enough, eventually you will just... this will just happen to you because of just how we're built, is eventually you fall apart in this specific way. So, like, if medical science manages to drastically extend our lives, then pretty much all of us, unless they find a way to cure cancer, which is about the same way as saying if they find a way to cure sick, we will all get it, and we will all die that way. So much for, like, that idea. Like, I would rather be uploaded into my robot body.
Yeah, I think I'd rather have that, too. Upload me to a computer.
Yeah, I want to have my robot claws and be the clamps.
I like to be... You ever seen Captain America and the Winter Soldier? Whenever they found not Zemo, what's the evil German scientist that has actually been in a computer program the entire time?
Oh, yeah, I forget. He was playing by that one...
Yeah, whatever.
Zoloft.
I want to be that guy, where I'm just in a computer but eventually found by a hero, and I'm like, I've been here the entire time. You know, just, what were you doing? Playing Tetris. I'm very good at it.
I've mastered the game of solitaire.
Yeah, but, like, you know, it's interesting. I think you could argue my main gripe with this book is that I liked it so much, and I'm struggling to find things I disliked about it. Like, very much struggling to criticize it.
Yeah, it's a very difficult book to actually find the flaws to it, other than, like, we were talking about how people review it, and, like, the people that hate this book are exactly the people you might assume are going to hate it. That if you have a real, like, axe to grind with evolution and the big scientific community, you're not going to like this book.
It's going to be like, what's that Georgia congressional candidate a few weeks back, Herschel Walker, was like, well, if evolution's true, why are there still apes?
Yeah.
Which is the argument every single anti-evolution person's made.
Since the dawn of, like, since the, what is it, the Scopes trial?
You figure their argument would evolve a little bit more.
No, because that would be admitting, even tacitly, that this concept has value.
So, damn it.
Stick to
what you know doesn't work.
Don't change.
That's my motto. But no, that's, honestly, like, that is kind of a problem that I have. Not a problem. It's just good. Like, it's a book I just enjoyed. And when it was over, I was like, so a lot of times for this podcast, when I know I'm going to have to, I will, and I, like I say this every time, I don't. But every once in a while, if I'm being proactive enough, I'll make some notes, like, oh, I didn't really like this here. And I thought, oh, I'm going to do this book. It's a shorter book. It's only like 8 hours long. And I realized I was about six and a half hours in, And at no point did I have any like negative... Books. I'm like, that's not good. Because usually, especially books you pick because you have terrible taste. I have nothing but negative.
Oh, how I'm going to make you read more Space Fires books.
Like...
Oh, you are going to not enjoy the Andromeda Strain.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. Sort of the same thing that felt too real.
Yeah.
Is, I think it's, I can't remember if it's in the epilogue or if it's some, it's somewhere towards the end of the book. He's talking about what's basically going to be the end of humanity. Yeah. And one of the examples he brings up is, it'll probably be a pandemic. and because basically we live close together, we're very close-knit, we've a big shared world, that it'll probably be something like that. And this book was written in 2017, 2018, I think. Yeah. And for the last 2 years we've been living in, it felt a little too real. Not that we really faced an extinction level event,
but
obviously, because COVID wasn't that.
Yeah.
But it makes you realize, though, that if there ever was like a virus that had like a 95% death rate,
oh, we'd be fucked.
We're done. Maybe. That's it.
Because like the latest go around with a pandemic, with the mortality rate of COVID as it is, the idea that there was still this huge contingent of people that are just like, I don't believe it's real. And yet, this number of Americans haven't died in any war that we've ever fought. And people are like, yeah, that seems fine. That seems about right for a bad flu year, even though it's orders of magnitude different.
Yeah, it's and there's still people that make that argument. Like, oh, there's nothing different than the flu. It's much different, but okay. When it makes you happy, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think that we've gotten through enough pretending to find things that we dislike about this book. So you want to move on into our parting thoughts?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's the best. I think the main sort of takeaway from this book is that I think it's a really impressive way to teach science.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that like too many like I think about like the times when I was like in high school or in college and learning science stuff. It felt very like, okay, I'm bored of this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a huge problem. I'm a person that loves learning. And I felt like we teach science in this very dry, very like mundane kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually a reason that Bill Nye is so popular. Because he makes science appealing. He makes it feel like it's attainable. You can grab it and learn it and it's nice. I think this book in a lot of ways is similar in that. Where it felt really nice to have a book that taught these very big, broad topics. But in a way that was entertaining and engaging and warm, and it felt fun to learn it. And I wish that more like science things did that, because then we'd have. I think scientific literacy, or really scientific illiteracy, is a huge problem in globally, but especially in the United States, where I feel like we'd have a lot less problems with sort of trusting in science if we taught it in a more like inclusive way.
Yeah, like how this book does it is very engaging, and like I think what you said there is like especially in the United States. Is we've lost ground in STEM and getting excited about the next big science thing. And like we've gotten to this point where we're more interested in the more vapid elements of life, or the more, if not vapid, but strictly pragmatic views of life. And we've lost a lot of that curiosity. And I think people roll their eyes whenever they hear about a job like Bill Nye's or Neil deGrasse Tyson, and before them, Carl Sagan. The science communicator, well, what does that mean? That they could make it as a real scientist? And like, is that a real job? Like, that's the kind of natural inclination we have in society. But what they do is they make people passionate about these topics. And like, they expose people to things and concepts and ideas that you just wouldn't normally get if somebody didn't engage you with it. And I think that's the thing that is missing a lot in science classes, like you were talking about, and how in school you were very bored by your science teacher. And like I had a couple of science teachers who were really, really talented people, and that's why I was always kind of interested in space stuff. Plus my parents were very scientifically minded people, so that's why I was engaged in it. But I knew tons of people growing up where like they just weren't engaged with it because nobody had ever put it in such a way that like that was either funny or thoughtful or interesting. It was just, well, this is what it is, and it's just like math, where unless you have this specific interest, you're just not going to get into it.
And I think that's a shame,
Yeah.
Because I feel like, you know, this book to me was a great example of science is fascinating, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's just, it explains how things are. And, like, I know it seems so simple and so, like, obvious, but when you think about it, we are kind of spiraling around. But, you know, we like to try to, like, find meaning. Humans are very meaning-oriented. We like to things that make sense. We like to things sort of put things in a box. And science, in all reality, is the explanation for that, for a lot of this. And I think that, like, the reason in America, especially, we have a big problem with people going, I don't like that science stuff. I don't know why I feel really bad making fun of people with that accent, but... Yeah, sorry.
There's probably at least one or two.
That, yeah, you know, like, and,
you know, doctorates.
Yeah.
Like, there are very progressive people, and you're just, like, trashing.
What if Einstein sounded like a yinzer? Like, would he be as well remembered?
I'm pretty sure that Einstein sounded like he had a German accent.
Would he be as well remembered if he was like, say, anyway, so E equals MC squared? It ain't that complicated.
There are, like, four people that are going to get this that happen to listen to this in Pittsburgh, where we live.
But, like, honestly, though, like, this book really made me just really appreciate sort of the explanation of why things are the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's not enough for some people. Maybe just the way... It's like explaining the magic trick.
Yeah.
Where sometimes people like the magic trick. And this book even talks about why the human brain can't comprehend magic tricks and illusions, mm-hmm. you know, in a lot of ways. And maybe that's why a lot of people don't like science, because it explains it and are like, no, I don't like that. I don't want to know this.
Well, I think that everybody has to make a decision at some point in their adulthood. It's whether or not you believe... to some degree, whether or not magic is real. That despite all the evidence, for whatever reason, you've decided that magic can be real in this circumstance. People might think, well, no, I don't believe magic is real at all. But then in the same breath, will tell me about ghosts. Like, and go, well, ghosts are just absolutely real. Everybody's seen it. Like, but that means that you believe that in some way... that the laws of nature can somehow be suspended because...
You want to believe that a house is haunted.
Yeah. And I get the impulse of, like, we all want to believe that there is something after this. To some degree, I think that everybody at least starts at that position. Like, but the idea that, like... I personally have invested in the idea that I hope ghosts are not real. Because my luck, I'd come back, and I don't want to have to, like, spend my afterlife bothering Stephen with, like, turning his hot water to cold.
That's just, yeah, you know, I'm not, I don't really believe magic is real. Like, the only thing I know for certain is that my horoscope is true.
Yeah, I'm a Pisces.
So yeah.
I'm not actually a Pisces, I think I'm an Aries.
I can't remember what I am. I don't really think, to be honest, I think it's all kind of nonsense, so.
I hope Aries and Pisces are in, like, the same thing rather than just combine two things.
I don't know. I actually am horrible. I always stupidly get astrology, which is nonsense, and astronomy mixed up.
Yeah.
Which is not nonsense.
Yeah.
And then I feel like an asshole when I'm like, oh, I'm an astronomer. Well, what a fucking waste of life you are.
I work at the observatory.
Oh.
Oh, you're the good one.
Oh, you're the good one. Sorry, my mistake. I'm stupid. You know, but, like, that's such a good point that, like, it is, like, eventually you have to come to the point where what do you accept, you know... People that are so logic-brained in certain aspects, what's that called? Cognitive dissonance, where, like, you can sort of have two very different things rolling around in your head. And, like, oh, I believe in science, but I also believe that when I die, I'm going to be rewarded with paradise and heaven. I'm going to see all my old friends and grandparents again. Like, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not trying to, like, impugn people that believe in an afterlife, believe in God or whatever. That's, you know, God bless if that's what you want out of this. You know, that's fine. But to me, it's hard to jive a lot of those more, like, abstract concepts with, like, the sort of logic side of of the brain. They just don't work.
Yeah, I mean, and to play devil's advocate, see what I did there?
Mm.
There's no way to know what happens next. Like, because nobody really has actually gone there and come back to tell us. And, like, of course there are those stories about, like...
All those little kids.
The little kids that have seen heaven or whatever. But it... I'm not really impressed by those things where, like, well, he was clinically dead for 5 minutes. But the brain does things for well after the heart stops beating. Like, it doesn't just all turn off like lights in a house. They just, things go slow down. And, like, your perception of time is, and the concept of false memory, it gets really strange. So, like, what would impress me if somebody has been dead for, say, I don't know, a year, and then came back?
Turns out,
I'd be more inclined to believe that person, whatever they told me was on the other side. Because that would be like, oh, yeah. Jim wasn't just dead a little bit. He was all dead. He was dead for a year. Like, so maybe we need to listen to what he has to say. Even if he's fucking lying. I mean,
maybe
he has the best guess.
I really would love nothing more than if like a religion or not is proven real. I want it to be not one of the obvious religions. Was there Jesus? No, it turns out Christianity is completely nonsense. Oh, so Judaism won? Oh, no, Judaism also nonsense. Which one won? Well, have you heard of Episcopalians? But without the Jesus part? I guess. That's actually the correct religion.
Well, I mean, Zoroastrianism.
Yeah,
that's also a form of
Hinduism is actually the one true.
Yeah, sure.
Like that to me is, like, I'd be fascinated by that. But no, I think that, like, you know, to get back to this book a little bit before we close out here, I think what's sort of the main takeaway, the main thing I really want to stress is that I really think it's important that we teach better scientific literacy.
Yeah.
If we want any chance of really continuing on in any kind of meaningful way, we got to make people appreciate and love and be like thirsty for science.
Mm-hmm.
And I think right now we're really failing in that as a country. And that's a lot of that is because people budgets are cut and science is sort of passed over, or you have certain parts of the country that are like, nope, evolution's not true. It's all about God made everything, and
he did a perfect job.
And you can't teach anything else. It's all evil, and that's bad. And you know, I'm not trying to I don't want to make it seem like I'm trying to disparage people's religious views, because that's fine. They're entitled to that. You're entitled to think whatever you want and believe whatever you want, but there are facts that need to be taught and accepted. And I'm sorry. They just are. If you're a person who goes, well, I mean, I don't really believe in evolution. Okay, you're stupid. I'm sorry. Screw it. I'm making someone mad. But I'm sorry, you're dumb. The moment I meet somebody and they go, I don't believe in evolution, I think it's all ridiculous, I immediately know everything I need to know about that person. I don't care anything they say, anything else. To me, I know they're dumb.
I have a softer view. I agree with you that I believe that those people are wrong. But a lot of times I find that those people are the victims of exactly what we're just saying.
Yeah, that's
a lot of times people go, well, I don't believe in evolution. They don't, not all the time. Sometimes people are just assholes about it. But a lot of time, it's just because they have been failed by our education system
that's
in some way.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And that they have not been, people haven't taken the time to engage with them and correct their misconceptions about stuff. And I find nobody actually ever changes their mind because they were told they were stupid.
That's fair. I'm sorry, everyone out there. Kevin wins. I'm actually the dumb. That's a good point. That's a failure of system. Yeah, that's a really. I feel bad now.
I did something like that. I talked about in when was this review where I in my written review. I did something that I was kind of ashamed of.
Oh, yeah, I can't. Yeah, yeah.
But people make mistakes. People, you get frustrated with, because you want to, you know what you want the world to be like.
You want to shake people that you wish they could
And you just wish they would just,
yeah,
get on board with the what you think is the right thing. And, it's easy to do. And I get frustrated with people. And I go, well, he's an idiot. Yeah, maybe, or maybe somebody just didn't take the time.
Idiots aren't born, they're made.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they're made because of a failure of a process.
Well, I want to, it seems like a good place to leave off, but what I want to do that's a little bit different this time is, just so everybody who's listening knows what to expect, we were talking about what book we're going to do next.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's your pick next, so what book are we going to be talking about next?
So we're actually not doing a traditional book. We're doing the Bible. We're actually doing the DC comic story, kind of, by Neil Gaiman, The Sandman, which kind of worked out because just a couple weeks ago, the sort of second story, I guess second book, second season, if you want to call it that, was released on Audible.
It's like a radio drama.
It's like a it's pretty much a radio serial. If you look at it that way, it's very much like a dramatized, like old school, like Grey Ghost or you know things like that. And it's really cool. And it's really fast. James McAvoy plays the title character.
Yeah.
And he's incredible as it. And the second one just came out. We're doing the first one.
Yeah.
We're not doing the second one yet. And I'm really excited because radio is my day job. I'm very passionate about radio. I love, you know, audio. And hearing a very much modern, up-to-date radio drama was right in my bread and butter. And I cannot wait to, like, dive into it and really deep dive discuss it because I think it's going to be really fascinating.
And, you know, and by God damn it, we're going to get you into audiobooks one of these days. Like, I know you're out there, David. You didn't know that I knew that you were listening, David. But you are going to listen to those audiobooks.
But I love the smell of real books.
All right. That's a good night. Yeah. We'll talk to you. We'll see you in April.